welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. And if you're wondering what that means, well, it's cancer care that addresses all the needs of people as far as possible, whether that's physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual. It's a leave no stone unturned approach that's prepared to consider any and every avenue to healing in the best interest of those with cancer. A good way to sum up the approach that we advocate at Yes to Life is with the strapline for our Charter for Oncology, which is love as the guiding principle for cancer care. And if you haven't seen our charter, which is calling for a very different approach to cancer care, then take a look by visiting our website, that's yestolife.org.uk, scrolling down the homepage a little, and then following the links to the charter. As part of Yes to Life's 20th anniversary, we're focusing on particular topics within integrative cancer care each month. And this month, the spotlight is on a couple of things, one of which is repurposed drugs. Nowadays, you don't have to look far outside the box of conventional care to stumble on repurposed drugs. But that wasn't the case until relatively recently, and the person we can attribute that to is Jane McClelland. Jane is what is called an extraordinary survivor, which means her life should have been cut short many, many years ago by terminal cancer. The fact that she's very much here to tell the tale is down to her research into the potential for a combination of old drugs developed for other purposes and natural products. Hi, Jane. Great to have you back on the Yes to Life show.
Hi, Robin. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Do you realise last time you were my guest was in 2021, more than 3 years ago?
Ignorance.
Yeah, so let's just say it's been too long. But meanwhile, we have worked together on a fantastic event this past autumn called the Repurposing Revolution, which you and Dr. Michael Castro delivered here in London and internationally online. And if anyone's unable to attend, there is a recording of it available from the Yes to Life shop at yestolife.shop.org. So the concept of repurposing is almost well known amongst people with cancer. I say almost, as that really applies to those with the courage to look outside the box. Tragically, your oncologist is still very unlikely to be telling you anything at all about repurposing. But the familiarity they've gained can, I think, be almost entirely attributed to you and your book, How to Starve Cancer. In fact, I think to a lot of people, you appear to have invented repurposing. But of course, actually, you took on an existing raft of knowledge, and then you expanded and developed on that to an enormous degree. So I wonder if you start out by telling us about the very beginnings when you first got the idea of doing this yourself. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, I was running out of options at that point. I'd tried pretty much everything that I thought was complementary. I'd already had a lot of chemo, a lot of radiotherapy, and I didn't want to have more of those because it had caused a problem in my bone marrow. I then, you know, I had a deleted P53 that suddenly emerged. I had all sorts of markers which were going haywire, something called PKM2, which measures glycolysis in your cells. And also I had MMPs, these are sort of growth factors, which had gone off the scale as well. So there are a lot of things that were going wrong. And the prognosis was looking pretty poor. I already had stage 4 at this point. So I was a bit desperate. I knew that I was heading off into bad territory. So I'd done a lot of intravenous vitamin C. I'd done a lot of, you know, I already had lots of supplements and things that I was taking. I had actually dropped my markers way down by using intravenous vitamin C, but they bounced back up again. And I wasn't sure at the time what I'd done, but I think because I was doing a parasite cleanse and things like that, I think I'd actually probably done a bit of ferroptosis because I'd used artemisinin in combination with vitamin C and some other things as well. But that, obviously, I didn't know that at the time. And I probably would have done a bit more intravenous vitamin C and maybe used that kind of combination again, but I was at a point where I was really struggling to know what to do next. And I had already read some of these articles and I'd kind of kept a folder on them. And so I dug them out and thought, right, I'm going to have to go for this. I'm going to have to look at these old drugs. One of them was dipridamole, which, you know, the research went back to the 1980s. So I went running off to Dr. Calabou, who sadly is no longer with us. Fantastic integrative doctor he was. He was very happy to prescribe that for me. And I went back to my oncologist. I gave her some research on the combination of a statin and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. The one specifically used in the article was etodolac. Now, that is normally used for arthritis, and statins are normally used for cholesterol, but the combination of the two showed that there was an increased cancer kill for specifically for cervical cancer, but other cancers as well. So I thought, well, that's probably a really good combo to add in. And then I, so it was just a sort of a gradual process of adding these things in. I had berberine, but later I went and got myself some metformin. Cimetidine I use, which is used to be over the counter in the UK for gastric ulcers. You can get it elsewhere in Europe, but this was something else that I could see was going to help my immune system. Back then, I didn't know, but I've since been diagnosed, probably since we last chatted, I've been diagnosed, I think it was 2020 I was diagnosed actually with cystic fibrosis. Weird genetic mutations that I have, not your common genetic mutations, but I was really worried about my immune system. So the cimetidine was to try and boost my immune system. And actually what it did with the cancer is help switch the balance between something called your Th1 and Th2, which is your ability to kill your cancer cells, or otherwise you have more of a humoral response and allergy kind of response. So you need to switch it back to killing the cancer cells. And this is what the cimetidine did. So it was a combination of a few things. And it was actually the cocktail that was key for me. It wasn't just taking these things individually. I had this concept that I was gradually adding things, layering things in that would synergize with each other. So to begin with, I knew that the lovastatin and the non-steroidal would have a 5x multiplying effect. So I also knew that the dipridamole and the statin would also synergize. So that, I thought, would maybe boost the cocktail a bit more. And actually what happened was I got rid of the cancer, but I didn't expect that at all.
No, no. Right.
That was
a nice very, surprise.
Very nice bonus. Thank you very much.
So yeah. That sort of cocktail thing, is that's where it all began, really, the idea of just adding in bits and pieces.
It's the synergy, which I think is important, that people need to understand there are particular combinations that work especially well. And that was something I talked about in the talk, Fiesta Life, was something called synthetic lethality. And this is the ability of two pathways on my metro map to really synergize well. And stimulate cancer cell death, if you like. So that's keys to understand which pathways really work together well.
Yeah. So when I talk about the fact that you developed this art to an enormous degree, it's really in that area, because prior to that, there were a few pioneers already saving or extending their own lives, sometimes with a single drug, and they were doing their best to tell the world, but of course, they weren't listening generally. Maybe you read of some of them at the time, but I think the kind of complexity of bringing these things together and building up a program in this way is the thing that is unique to you, that you've actually done at this time.
I wasn't aware of anybody else using these old drugs, except that they had been given. So for melanoma, for example, the dipridamole had been given to stage 4 cancer patients at St. Helier Hospital. And what happened was that these cancer patients were surviving.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, that's so it was all serendipity, if you like.
Exactly. That's the sort of thing that I've read about as well, is that you give a drug for one purpose, trying to help them with one problem, and you notice 3 years later that that population isn't getting cancer. It's kind of like, well, why not? And so, yeah, it's funny the way that the information has been generated in this kind of backhanded way, but it's there.
Yeah, and the same thing for mebendazole, actually, because they were just trying to get rid of parasites in mice. They gave various anti-cancer drugs, and then giving them the mebendazole showed, or fenbendazole, I think it was actually, because it's a veterinarian drug. So they gave that to begin with, and then, hey presto, all the cancer, the gliomas that they had, disappeared. So, again,
messed up their trial.
Yeah, but Gregory Riggins is all over that now, and he's the researcher in Boston who discovered that. So he's mebendazole is fantastic, and he uses that for kids with brain cancer. So that's a really important thing, because I think the ability to get drugs for children is really limited.
Yes.
And that's one thing that really worries me, is that we kind of can treat ourselves. If we're over 18, we can get all sorts of things through various means. I have a list of doctors on my website. But if you are underage, if you like, for getting some of these things, it's very hard to find somebody who will prescribe anything for you. There seem to be, the rules. I don't know if there are specific rules, but I think doctors are more wary about that than forgiving.
Oh, definitely. It doesn't just apply to the drugs. It's right across the board, and it's because of the fact that the person themselves can't give their own consent legally. So it's the parents who are doing it, so it's sort of third party. And at the end of the day, I mean, if you look at the relationship between the NHS and a child, for example, if they have a life-threatening disease, then the NHS can actually make all the decisions about what happens to that child against the wishes of the parent if they want to. So, it isn't great, but that's how it is. And, of course, this is a very thorny legal area that lots of practitioners are very wary of, understandably. But who suffers? Well, the children. They don't have any access to all sorts of potentially helpful things. So, look, in today's show, I don't want to make any assumptions about what our listeners know already, and I want to take someone who knows nothing about repurposing along with us on the journey. So an obvious question someone might have at the outset is, well, look, here are these drugs, they're out there already, they're relatively safe, they can really help. Given the number of people dying from cancer, why wouldn't oncologists be over the moon about that? And why wouldn't the drug companies be shouting about the amazing breakthrough use for their drugs in the tabloids?
Well, obviously, the latter part of that question with the big pharma is quite obvious. A lot of these things have actually reached their patent, the end of their patents. So you have a lot of generics available out there, which are produced by Indian pharmaceutical companies or, all over the world, much cheaper. And of course, they enter into the market, a huge competition for these big companies. So they try and extend the shelf life of these patents. They try and, tweak them a little bit to give them an extra few years. But ultimately, that we are reaching what's known as a patent cliff. And a lot of the old, atorvastatin is off patent. All of the what I deem to be the sort of the top off-label drugs at the moment for cancer that I can see, the ones that really hit some of these metabolic pathways, the feeding routes, the nutrient feeding routes of cancer, all seem to be off patent now. So that's clearly an issue.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be the difference between, if you're talking about one patient, potential money-making difference of like maybe tens of thousands of pounds and a few quid, basically.
Yeah, that's
is that right?
Right. And the problem with that is that big pharma sort of are obsessed, and they try and drum into the doctors the need for randomized clinical trials, and that they shouldn't be giving anything unless a randomized clinical trial shows it's better than another drug or shows it's, but of course we don't have that with some of these old drugs, unless they are using them in combination with a new drug. So there's a new mAb, which is coming out A mAb is a sort of a monoclonal antibody, which is an immunotherapy drug.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one that they are bringing out for triple negative breast cancer, and they are using it in combination with ivermectin, which shows that it works an awful lot better. So they've already gone for looking at the combination to try and steal a march on some of the other drugs out there by saying, yeah, well, look at the results. It's so much better with my drug plus the, you know, the ivermectin, just to increase the response rate that they get with patients. So it's actually twisting. And
that's interesting, isn't it?
It'd be a good thing if the big pharma actually cottoned onto this a little bit more. They, you know, this is a good way to try and drive new sales by actually doing combination trials.
So they're capitalizing on the effectiveness of out-of-patent drugs to make the new drugs more effective.
Yeah. And it's all about synergy. It's all about, you know, that's what I try and educate people. It's not about alternative methods. This is a way of making traditional, conventional drugs work more effectively. And this is a message that seems to be lost on the doctors and the oncologists. They all are sold the idea that I'm alternative, which I am. I wouldn't say I walk that middle path between what is known as, you know, alternative and the conventional path, but I'm trying to link them together and say we need better effects with better combinations, better synergies, and we need to look at drugs that will actually improve the efficacy of what you're using. Stop resistance. It's all about stopping resistance in a lot of these drugs. And that's something that I talk about a lot, because my Metromap really is to look at pathways that get active, upregulated. When you take a drug, there is always a pathway that increases, which raises the risk of the cancer switching and using a different path. So it's not necessarily stop using that drug. It's you need to use a combination to make it more effective, or just to stop that resistance.
Yeah, it's a big issue.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colours or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It's pretty straightforward to see why the drug companies wouldn't be interested.
Yeah.
Simply on business grounds. But when it comes to oncologists, this is where you and people like you start to be labeled as conspiracy theorists for even asking the questions. The classic line we hear all the time is, well, if these drugs really work, don't you think we'd be using them?
Yeah, I know. And where's the evidence, of course, is, you know, and that is a problem, is looking at the evidence, and there is epidemiological evidence for a lot of these drugs, certainly for metformin, for statins, for aspirin, and a combination of those three. There's a Korean study that shows that survival is significantly longer. But you need to look at individual studies as well, but not just of the drug itself, because if you look at studies of metformin on its own, it doesn't work very well. Right. It really doesn't. And that's the problem, is that they'll always throw up, oh, well, look at this study, that showed. And I didn't, you know, I gave a talk not that long ago to a whole load of researchers and doctors, and that was absolutely the response that I got. Well, this study showed that metformin didn't work. You know, and you need to understand that if you're looking at metformin in vitro, then it's not really going to have much of an effect. Actually, metformin affects the gut, and we know the microbiome is absolutely essential. We need to get the right metabolites and the right bacteria in your gut to fight cancer. So that's where, you know, a lot of its effect actually is on the gut itself. It reduces the amount of sugar generally in the whole body. So it's a sort of a reduction of that. It blocks something called gluconeogenesis, which is what the body does when it starts to become a bit low on glucose. The liver switches on these pathways to break down fat and sometimes protein as well to release energy and to change it into glucose so you can get, you know, get the energy. And it actually damps that down, which is one of its big plus points for metformin, is that's what it does. But you don't see that if you're testing it in a, you know, in vitro. You don't see that.
Right. So just to be clear for all the listeners, in vitro means somewhere in a test tube in a lab and not in a real person.
No, exactly.
And yeah, it's a very different terrain for something to be tested in. So the message we get from them is, you know, the drugs don't work, which makes you into the lunatic fringe for saving your own life by the way you did.
Oh, complete lunacy.
And the effect of all this denial is to perpetuate the myth of alternative quack medicine and kind of take the attention away from the most important question of what's actually working. You know, in order for the mainstream to be right, people like you, Jane, I'm afraid you've just got to be wrong. And this is where it's kind of the foundation of the black and white, good, bad, proven, unproven tabloid nonsense that's enormously unhelpful for people who are trying to stay alive in the face of cancer.
Absolutely unhelpful.
You know, everybody is pressured to line up dutifully behind one side or the other. So you're either a sensible, compliant person or you're a conspiracy theorist. And so you're going to entirely miss the benefits of being helped by either or both, which that now at least has got a proper name, integration. That's what we like. And so, you know, just want to ask, you know, 6 years after the publication of your book, in terms of a broader acceptance of your ideas, well, how's the progress?
I think it's amazing, actually. I know I've had this massive effect on patients, which I love, but I'm now starting to creep more into the sort of the doctor realm, and even the not just the integrative doctors who seem to be very aware of me now. Across the world, you know, and an awful lot of people, and this, you know, seen as Paul Marrick read my book, and he's written a book called Cancer Care, which he thought that maybe my ideas weren't specific enough for cancer. I know it's very annoying for people that I don't put down particular protocols for different types of cancer in my book. I give a general guideline for people to go and do their homework, to research on their own. And I think that's really important for people and empowering for people to go out there and be forced to look at the research, because they will realize I'm not talking nonsense at this point. And, you know, this is key, I think, for the patient and for an empowering point of view to actually get them in the driving seat, to make them feel like they're actually in control. You know, research is the answer and education is the answer. So he wrote a book called Cancer Care, and his book has been taken down in the UK on Amazon. And mine was briefly, my both editions. I know that I have some opponents out there who are very traditional, conventional. These are not even oncologists, all right? These are people, they are self-styled experts who think they know what they're talking about, but they haven't done the deep research. They really haven't. So unfortunately, you know, that's where I am at the moment, fighting people who haven't understood how cancer develops. And, you know, a particular one of these opponents is bringing out a book in February, which I know is going to be trying to dispel the myths of cancer, etc. But she's talking from last century, unfortunately.
Okay, we'll see.
I'm looking forward to reading it and actually seeing what she says.
So look, repurposing of drugs is kind of the headline, if you like, but it's the thing that a lot of people have heard of. But actually you were, and you are intent, actually not on the drugs, but on the metabolic pathways, on starving cancer, as you so graphically described it in your book title. And if a drug happened to be the best way of doing that, you were onto it. But that said, it's important to say that it was the result that you were after, and the method was incidental to that. In fact, I think it'd be fair to say that you have a preference for using a natural product if you can achieve the same effect. Am I right?
Well, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I was really worried about taking the drugs when I had that option, but I couldn't see natural alternatives that would be equivalent. And I think this is important for people to know, that there's still a huge amount of resistance to statins, because it reduces your CoQ10 and other things. And they think that cholesterol is important. Actually, cancer cells are different to any other cells. You know, they have their own metabolism. They actually manufacture cholesterol inside the cell as part of energy storage. And a lot of cells do that. In particular, cancer cells do that more than others. So we see that statins are particularly useful for certain cancers like ovarian and breast, melanomas. They all respond very well to statins. But you kind of have to keep an open mind with cancer. You can't, I like to be fairly, I'd say I'm quite agnostic about what works and what doesn't. As long as it works, try it, you know?
Right.
And think about, yeah, and that goes with traditional treatments, you know, the whole conventional side. Don't dismiss them and say, right, I'm just going to do natural. You need to look at it, but you actually need to look at the dose as well, because if you have more in your cocktail, you probably don't need the same dose as somebody who's just doing a one approach. If you have more things, then you can dilute the other things down a little bit. So, I did take quite a lot of stuff, which, you know, led to my nickname Maracas, because I've taken so many supplements.
Yes.
But, you know, that's part of how I got through. Because I didn't know what was actually going to work at the time, and I was throwing everything at it. So
absolutely reasonable. The result speaks for itself. A very important term you used at the beginning of that, which is open-minded. And, you know, I've known over the 20 years I've been doing this, I've dealt with a lot of people I felt were not open-minded enough. And that's not just on one side or the other, it's either side. Some people are not open-minded enough about conventional medicine, and some people are not open-minded enough about the other options that could be mixed in. And they've suffered as a result, I felt. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but this is just my opinion.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad,
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
I've seen many people, I'm sure, go down one route or another, and that you have evangelists for a particular type. So you have keto evangelists, you have, you know, cannabis evangelists, you have you end up with this shouty noise from a particular part of the you know, integrative movement, and you need to understand there are pros and cons with everything. Even with my stuff, there are pros and cons with it. Some people can't take some of the drugs, you know, if your liver's a mess, then you have to be very careful. And if you're already on blood thinners or whatever, you probably can't take dipyridamole. Or maybe you could swap the blood thinner you're on for dipyridamole. I do think there are, you know, potentially a lot of people would benefit from that. But, you know, that there are reasons why people get fixated and they go down this little narrow path. And I think researchers are partly to blame because they go down this little route and they see that their particular avenue of research is producing fantastic results, and then they test it in the mouse, they can see fantastic results, but it's actually getting those results over into humans, which is always a tricky thing. And we do need to have trials, and we do need to have human trials with a lot of this stuff. I would love my cocktail to be properly evaluated. I mean, the Care Oncology did put together some tests which are in trials, which were real-world trials rather than randomized clinical trials, because you can't really do that in this situation. It's very hard to do.
Plenty of argument to say they're superior anyway.
Yeah. So, but they did one on GBM, and they looked at results of that over a few years, and they found, you know, that
That's good.
And I know people who have full remission of GBM from using cocktails of drugs. So, yeah,
it's great. Anyway, I think it's an interesting two-way synergy that happens there between the evangelist and the natural desires of patients as well, because the whole thing about actually being, as you described, open-minded all the time is everything's always a bit unknown. You actually got to go forward with everything being uncertain, and people crave for certainty. They crave for the simple answer that's going to get them out of this mess. And when somebody comes along and says, yep, I've got it here, it's very appealing.
It is really appealing. And I never guarantee anything. What I do is I say, look, you've just got to carry on researching for yourself. And that's the best we can do. And I think it's important for people to consult with doctors who are experienced in this area. Mm-hmm. I've updated my list, by the way, on my website for the doctors in the UK.
Okay.
I just think it's important for people to talk to metabolic doctors who have worked in this field for a while, because that they need to hear from the white coat, not just from people like me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. It gives confidence. Yeah, very good. Anyway, super important message for people with cancer who want to stay alive. Yeah, remain open-minded. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about today is cancer theory.
Oh.
If someone listening's been recently diagnosed, I think they would be forgiven for thinking, surely I don't need to learn about that stuff. I can leave it to the boffins. But actually, it is a really important issue to understand, because it provides the very foundation for the us and them wars in cancer, in that the theory that's being used by the oncologists, that they've been taught that underpins their approach to treatment is not the same one that drives your thinking, for example, and nor that for a growing raft of integrative practitioners. So I wonder if you'd outline in the simplest terms and explain the difference between the theories and why people with cancer would do well to understand what theory is behind any treatment they're offered.
Well, there are multiple theories.
That's true. But we're going to talk about the two big ones here.
Okay.
Conventional and the leader.
So the somatic theory is kind of the biggest theory that the conventional side will use to say that it is genetic. And the problem with that is that they think it's a sort of a random switching on of the genes, but they don't know why. All right. So the P53 is kind of like the guardian of the genome. And if the P53 gets altered or mutated or, you know, any kind of dysfunction in that gene changes the metabolism of the cell. And there's talk between mitochondria and the genome, you know, the nucleus in the cell. This goes on all the time. It's an interchange of information. But does that, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the mitochondria? Or is it the nucleus? Because the mitochondria actually has genetic material as well.
Just to be clear there for listeners, the mitochondria is the energy production facility inside the cell, yes?
And
is that and the nucleus we're talking about?
Yeah. So mitochondria resemble bacteria because that's what they were in ancient pre-multicellular form. There was a sort of an interplay between how the mitochondria produced energy and how the cell produced energy with, you know, and then they started the symbiotic process of working together. And this process of switching from fermentation of fuels to using oxygen for fuel, this is like if you go for a run and you run out of oxygen, your muscle cells will start producing lactic acid, right? This is a normal process. And this doesn't require genetic mutations. This is just a switch. Mm. It's just a switch that goes on and off. And it doesn't involve a mutation at all. And the process of cancer involves more of a switching on of these fermentation fuels. There are some cancers that actually are more driven by the normal Krebs cycle, which is producing energy, the ATP, which is your energy, just by the process. It's called OxPhos. I don't want to go into too much detail, but OxPhos and glycolysis are like the two pathways of producing energy, key pathways. All right. So you get this interplay. And with cancer, if you block one, you'll upregulate, you'll make the other one more active in order for the cell to create the energy to divide, produce all the DNA for its progeny, you know. So it's constantly looking to divide. It needs energy for this. It's constantly needing the food coming in from various sources. And this is switched on by lots of pathways first. Now, cancer, in my view, starts in the cell membrane. To start in the cell nucleus, how does that happen? It has to get to the cell. Something has to trigger it to get the cell nucleus to switch these genetic pathways on. And you've got lots of things on the cell surface that send signals into the cell. And the two key pathways for that are inflammatory pathways, which are triggered by some cytokines. These are inflammatory pathways. So you get nuclear factor kappa beta and STAT3. Now, the balance of these two will depend on your cancer actually producing more energy through OxPhos or producing more energy through glycolysis. And this is kind of controlled by nuclear factor kappa beta, which is a big pathway. But this is signaled from inflammatory cytokines on the surface of the cell. So there's lots of stuff that goes on before you actually get down to what happens in the energy production. And then the genetic mutations happen afterwards.
Right.
It's downstream.
So this is a chicken and egg argument.
Yeah, but downstream is the sort of genetics. But there's epigenetics. This is the influence of the tumor microenvironment on the surface of the cell, which actually changes the messages that go in. So that's the important point, is that you actually need to look at the tumor microenvironment. That's the key. We know from research going way back to Mina Bissell, she's done a fantastic YouTube on that, and it's well worth people looking her up and watching that.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's important to look at all of these factors. And there are lots of things that can stimulate bad signaling on the surface of the cell, a lack of oxygen, pathogens. There are many things, you know, constant carcinogens or inflammation from trauma for over a long period. You know, lots of things actually cause this inflammation on the cell surface. And it's often a combination of things. One thing on its own is probably not going to do it. You need to have a combination of different things to actually change the epigenetics and actually change the way that the cell functions. And then it kind of gets into a vicious cycle of doing the wrong thing.
Mm. So, yeah, just putting it in chicken and egg terms, which is quite nice and sort of simple in a way, is that one theory is telling you that the problem is that we've got this genetic problem, which is then creating all the things you're talking about as being drivers, as saying they're downstream. So they are the result of the problem in the nucleus. But the metabolic theory, as we haven't given it its name yet, but that's the other theory.
Well, I would say it's actually more epigenetics and changing the material. I mean, cancer is a combination of epigenetics, metabolism and genetics. So, you know, you may be more susceptible to cancer if you've got a BRCA mutation. That it doesn't mean you're going to get cancer.
Right.
If these other factors are
contributory factors.
Yeah, but you know, the emphasis is all on, you know, these genetic mutations.
Yeah.
So when you look at a cancer cell and it has mutated, the reason it mutates is because it's finding different pathways to resist whatever treatment you're giving it.
Right. Well, interesting. That is the chicken and egg thing about it, though, is that something that you think of as a symptom, a conventional thinking is that that's a cause, and that the pathway and the behavior that you're looking at is a symptom. So each side is looking at it the opposite way. It's like through the looking glass.
You know, there probably are some cancers which are triggered directly by mutagens. So thyroid cancer, for example, you know, if you have radiotherapy or if you have some sort of high level of radioactive, so you have a lot of x-rays, might trigger a problem in your thyroid. Hiroshima, for example.
Right.
You know, so there are some things that are actually going to potentially trigger cancers directly. But that's rare. You know, that's if you look at the expanding number of people getting cancer today, we know it's the tumor environment that is causing this increase. And particularly in young people, you know, they're really not aware of the importance of what they're putting into their mouths. They think it's just fuel, you know, calories, that's all they need. But the quality of what you're putting in your mouth is absolutely key. And we have a lot of phytonutrients that are in plants that we should be having daily, and also micronutrients, magnesium, zinc, lots of things to boost the immune system and keep our metabolic processes happening normally. We're just not having, and magnesium is found in green vegetables. Are people having enough green vegetables? No, they're not
anymore. No.
So, yeah.
Right. Look, we're just about out of time. That was really great. Thank you. So it's just interesting to see how your attention is all on these pathways and what's happening in them. And have we lost control of what's happening there? And can we regain control somehow? But your message is you won't do it with one thing. You're going to have to do it with quite a lot of things. So don't think it's simple. It isn't. So I hope that's a good summary of Jane McClellan Potted.
Yes, they're in complex.
All right. So we're going to have to leave it there. I'd like to add my personal acknowledgement to all the accolades you've already had for taking a hugely important science and single-handedly lifting it from total obscurity to a level where there's probably barely an integrative practitioner in the world who hasn't at least heard of it or isn't actually practicing it themselves. So from your point of view, this has been a very top-level conversation today, I understand, as I know you're always used to plumbing the depths and the detail of complex networks.
I do.
I do hope it's been very helpful to people who are just lifting the lid on the topic and wondering if repurposing could have some potential to help them. So thank you very much, Jane.
Pleasure. Always wonderful to speak to you, Robin.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.
As I mentioned at the outset, Jane's and Dr. Michael Castro's presentations at Yes to Life's Repurposing Revolution seminar are available on video from the Yes to Life shop. That's yestolife.shop.org. Also, her thriving Facebook group, which is called Jane McClelland Off-Label Drugs for Cancer, is where you can join almost 100,000 others to learn and share. And you can also check out Jane's previous appearances on the Yes to Life show by going to the show page, that's yestolife.org.uk/radio-shows, yestolife.org.uk/radio-shows, and search for Jane by name in the guest search box. I sincerely hope you found today's interview helpful and interesting, and that you'll make a point of joining me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.